It's a pleasure to be here and spend a few days here. Very nice. So I'll be speaking about various topics, and I guess, as always in this field, it's a mixture of a review and speculation, and also some work, some technical stuff. About the technical stuff, you know, I won't be showing you a lot of the formula. I just hope that I'll be able to convey some of the concepts and ideas, and we can discuss that in private. And I was also not quite sure what kind of an audience to expect. So the first few transparencies will just be like very general and more cartoons than anything else. So I hope you forgive me for that. Oh, the outline of my talk is the first cartoon. Mm-hmm. So I'll be reviewing some work on black holes, which has recently become fashionable again. I will try to argue how and in which sense this could have something to do with topological strings. I won't be doing too much about this because I understand that Hiroshi Oguri was here a couple of weeks ago and probably gave a better exposition than something I could do here. And what I will then try to tell you is that this whole thing might be able, you might able be able to test this by looking at a very strange object, Phi 10. This is something that lives on a genus 2 surface, and I'll try to introduce you to that. So this is something which goes back to work of Dijkgraaf, Verlinde, and Verlinde, and I will introduce some of the key notions here. So how do we think about, how does string theory think about our four-dimensional world? Well, this is about the picture. We have four-dimensional space-time, and above every point we fix a very small Calabi-Yau. And this Calabi-Yau, you know, this can have different shapes and different sizes. And these shapes and sizes are parameterized by what we call moduli, and they are basically shape and size moduli, and I'll be denoting them by Y in this talk. And they come in a supergravity context, they come in either vector or hypermultiplets. And I'll be focusing mainly on vector multiplets. And of course, one has a whole bunch of other low-energy fields, like the graviton, the four-dimensional graviton, and all kind of other stuff. Now, since I think you know all of this, I can skip this. How do we think about black holes? Well, string theory, as you all know, also has extended objects. And these objects, if they are heavy enough, if they have enough mass, they can form horizons. Now, the important thing is that these horizons, they extend in the dimensions transversal to the dimensions where these extended objects are stretched along. So, for instance, here, if I drew such a blue extended object, and if this blue string here is heavy enough, then there will be a horizon which forms this cylinder shape around this black string. Now, of course, in four dimensions, we don't see, at least if we want to talk about black holes, we don't want black strings. So we would like to get rid of this extension of the string while keeping the horizon. And how you can think about this is taking one of these Calabi-Yaus here and wrapping the string various times around cycles of this internal small manifold, and then shrinking the manifold down to sizes which are much smaller compared to the size that we want to measure in our effective four-dimensional world. But due to the fact that these horizons are extended in the transverse directions, you will nevertheless still keep a horizon, a finite macroscopic horizon. Now, these wrapped brain configurations, they are basically characterized, and I'll be talking about supersymmetric configurations. And they are always characterized by two type of charges, winding and flux, and they correspond to electric and magnetic charge in four dimensions. So, for instance, winding is probably the easiest to visualize. That's just the amount of times that a brain wraps a specific cycle. So, for instance, if I have a four-brain, then it has four like spatial world volume directions, and then I can wrap that on a four-cycle. And which four-cycle, which linear combination of four cycles is just given by this integer number PA, which gives you, you know, like two times around the first, three times around the second. Flux is a bit more difficult to visualize, and I drew a picture here, but it might also be a bit misleading. If you say I have flux lines which go out from this string here, and now you start wrapping it, you know, closing the loop, then of course these flux lines must go somewhere, and then you can, well, so if they went out radially and you close the loop, then you can, I think you can understand that it will go through something which is orthogonal to the cycle it's actually wrapped. So these numbers Q here, they measure the flux which goes through the dual cycles, and in our case this would be two cycles if we are talking about a forebrain which is wrapped. And now the nice thing about it is that these gentlemen here, Maldesen, Stromming, Witten, and Waff, and many others, they were actually able to count the number of configurations of such wrapped brains, and count in how many different ways can I deform such a system characterized by these numbers P and Q, such that I still have the same long-range fields, the same gravity type of solution. And this is a difficult process, and I of course won't be able to review this here, but what typically happens is that you identify a sigma model of deformations of this brain model, and this typically is like a 1+1 dimensional conformal field theory. You can count the number of degrees of freedom, or the central charge, and use Cardy's formula to get an estimate for the entropy. And what these people found here in the case of a Calabi-Yau is the square root formula here for the degeneracy of microstates. You see here there's a Q here which is related to the flux or momenta, and then there's a cubic polynomial in the magnetic charges. This is probably not sharp, right? Is it sharp? A cubic polynomial in the magnetic charges, so the leading term goes like Q squared because it's under the square root. These numbers C, A, B, C, these are topological informations of your Calabi-Yau. These are the triple intersection numbers. And then there's a correction term which is subleading in the limit of large charges, which goes with the second Chern class numbers. This is just what comes out of the calculation. Now you might ask, how can any gravity description...
Is it 1+1? Where is the spatial dimension of that one coming from? Because these are not strings.
Yes, so what I didn't tell you here is that this is an M5 brain setup where four of them are on a four cycle and one is on an extra on the M theory cycle. So the 1+1 is comes from thing. I only need this formula because I will be reproducing this by a gravity calculation at some point. So to end this picture, this cartoon-like introduction, you can ask, well, what kind of an effect does such a very heavy brain have on your geometry, on your effective, on your space-time? Now, very far away. Now, these brains, they enter as sources in the effective action. So very far away, you know, the source is not really, really, really relevant. You will see like certain fall-offs of fields, but as you approach the place where the black hole is actually, where this black string, say, is wrapped, you will actually see that there's a strong back reaction, and in fact, a horizon, for instance. So you will find black holes, and the only way you can actually, so what you find, and this is what I'll be showing in more detail then, is that as you approach the place where this black object is sitting, the moduli fields and the metric and all kind of other fields, they get set to very specific points which are uniquely characterized by the charges. This is goes under the name of attractor mechanism and is probably the decisive ingredient in the whole analysis here. So now I would like to turn to the gravity description of this, and the gravity description in this situation is a super gravity description, n equals to 2. And as you may know, string theory induces, for all these massless fields, induces higher derivative terms. These come from stringy interactions. And in general, it's very difficult to figure out, you know, what these higher derivative terms are. In general, one doesn't really know so much. One knows that certain of them are there, but the supersymmetric completions are usually very difficult to figure out. But there's one class in four dimensions, there's one class of high derivative terms which is actually very well under control, and these are ones which are so-called chiral terms. Chiral means that you can take any function of chiral fields. Chiral fields basically depend only on half of the theta variables.
This is n equals 2 superfields?
This n equals to 2 superfields. Mm-hmm. Chiral superfields, they depend only on 4 of the possible 8 thetas. And if you take any function of such chiral fields, which I denote by y here, and you perform this integral, you will get something which is manifestly supersymmetric. Now, the vector multiplet, the y here, is such a chiral superfield. It's actually a reduced chiral superfield. But there's another one which will play a role in the following, and that's W squared. That's the square of the Weyl multiplet. That's a complicated multiplet which contains all the field strengths of the gravity sector. Okay? Now you can take a chiral superfield and multiply it with itself, it's chiral again. So I take the square and I work out the components. And it starts off with something like the graviphoton field strength squared, and then at its highest component there's a scalar C. And the scalar C has the following ingredients. It contains the anti-self dual part of the Weyl tensor squared, plus a whole bunch of other junk. One of this junk is, for instance, box under graviphoton field strength. So now you take this function and you use the knowledge of the components of these superfields, and you just go through the whole painful process of integrating out of all the thetas. And what you find is what you probably would expect. You find an Einstein-Hilbert term. You find kinetic terms for your scalar fields. You find kinetic terms for the field strengths. You know, the vector multiplets have vectors in it, so these are the kinetic terms for the field strengths. And then you find explicit higher derivative terms which go with a coupling constant, a moduli-dependent coupling constant, f sub w. This is the derivative of this function f with respect to w squared, multiplying exactly this highest component I showed you up here. So this is a whole, now depending on what you choose for f, you are describing a whole class of moduli-dependent high derivative terms, r squared terms, in the following. Yes?
So is this done in Euclidean space, or?
No, that's done in Lorentzian space.
So when you talk about an anti-self dual Weyl tensor, that's
yes.
not real.
That's not real. So everywhere here, I actually should put plus complex conjugate. And actually that's important because otherwise I could also form, you know, topological R-squared terms like the Gauss-Bonnet term. But because here I have different complex coupling constants, this is not always possible. Now these actions are very complicated, and especially if you don't know what the structure is, but they actually have a very nice structure, and part of the structure is a symplectic invariance of the field equations. And that means that at the level of the action, you have a whole set of inequivalent Lagrangians, namely through such symplectic transformations. And you know, if you want to really know what the relevant quantities is, you always have to work with quantities which have well-defined properties, transformation properties, under these symplectic reparametrizations. So for instance, the periods, or in terms of special geometry, they form a vector. So yi was the scalar of the vector multiplet, and fi is the derivative of the function f with respect to y. Also, the charges, for instance, they form vectors under these symplectic reparametrizations. Then there are other functions, for instance, f sub w, the coupling function of the r squared term. This is a scalar under symplectic reparametrization, so it's not invariant, but it's a scalar. Another nice thing, which will be important in the following, is that these functions f actually can be computed in string theory by doing topological string, computing topological string amplitudes. So this is something which was discovered in a very nice paper of Antoniadis, Gavanna, Rein, and Taylor. And they looked at amplitudes with two gravitons and two G gravi photons, and they found that the amplitudes they got reduced to amplitudes which are the equivalent to the topological, sorry. There were certain zero modes forced these to be actually topological amplitudes. And so you can actually calculate the whole dependence, the whole moduli dependence, by looking at topological amplitudes. Now I give you an example of this. Are there any questions until here? So an example, any Calabi-Yau actually has the following expansion. So in the perturbative limit, this function f is given by, again, a polynomial in the y's. So something which is very important, which I forgot to say, is that this function f must be homogeneous of degree 2. And as you see here, this is also homogeneous of degree 2. And what multiplies here is, of course, not of course, but is something you've seen already. These are these triple intersection numbers you saw in the entropy formula. And then over here, you have a subleading term. You see this is an R squared term because it goes with W squared. And this term here gets multiplied by the second Chern class numbers, something again you saw in the entropy formula. Something I'll be using a little bit later on is in the n equal to 2 context, you have all kind of higher terms, you know. You have f0, f1, f2, fg. All of them are non-vanishing, and all of them have alpha prime corrections in addition. For the n equal to 4 compactifications I'll be looking at, that string theory on these particular spaces, k3 times t2, there's only an f0 and an f1. All the others are vanishing. And in addition, f0 is exact in alpha prime. And what is also nice is that the complete form of f1 is known, and this I'll be using shortly. So now you can take these complicated Lagrangians with these complicated functions f, and you can ask if you can still find, you know, with these higher derivative terms, and you can ask if you still can find solutions to the field equations. Now, anybody who's ever tried to do so without having some powerful tools, of course, you know, it's very difficult to deal with high actions with higher derivatives. So, but if you look at supersymmetric configurations, this is actually very much possible. And so in the first step, you can, for instance, ask yourself, are there fully supersymmetric maxima? And then you find out that there are actually only two. It's either ADS2 cross S2. This persists to be a vacuum even in the presence of these R squared terms. Or there's flat Minkowski space. And then you can ask yourself, are there solutions which interpolate between these two vacua? And there's a whole set of solutions that were found by my collaborators and myself, and which actually do interpolate between them and include all these higher derivative terms. These higher derivative terms, I just want to stress this again, these are not arbitrary R squared terms, but these are always these R squared terms that can be brought into this particular class. So these are F term type R squared terms. That's why this actually works. And in the, yes?
I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but one thing do these R squared terms come with sort of like F squared term multiplying them?
F squared is the field strength.
F squared is like a field strength for one of your charges.
They come with a graviphoton field strength squared and higher powers of those.
Multiplying the R squared.
Right, and those will be related to the field strengths if you integrate out certain fields. So, in the presence of these particular R squared terms, you can actually prove the attractor mechanism again. And this proven in the following way. It's not actually proven in terms of a flow, but it's proven in the sense that you can actually solve for all the fields, at least for the field, the scalar fields and the vector multiplet, and they are given by these generalized attractor equations. So these H's here are harmonic functions, which are supported by the delta function type singularities where the charges sit. And what you can see is that in the limit where you approach the source, these harmonic functions are completely dominated by the pole, you know, by the singularities of these harmonic functions, which are given by the charges. So up to a rescaling of, you know, the radial coordinate, these moduli fields are completely determined in terms of the electric, magnetic and electric charges. So this here you should read as an equation for the imaginary part of y, and this for the real part of y. And there's an r squared dependence sitting implicitly in here. All other fields, like the metric and so, are fixed then in terms of these. Once this is known, you can solve for the others, at least in principle. This can of course be very difficult because equations, say for the metric, you have to solve them in a perturbative, in an iterative fashion, because you do at some point you do have higher derivatives, so you do have to solve nonlinear differential equations. By the way, these H's are completely arbitrary. They can also be multiple centers, so you can have multi-center solutions. There's nothing to prevent that.
What kind of ansatz do you start from to realize that?
None.
So you don't start from ansatz of a spherical symmetric entry?
No. We just put in statistics that it should be stationary.
Stationary or static?
That's included in static, right?
No, static
is static. Static is included in stationary,
yeah,
right?
So which do you start from? Static?
Stationary.
So you allow for some rotation.
In general, actually, this is very interesting. In general, these R squared terms prevent black holes from being static. So multiple center black holes, so black holes with multiple centers, in general, will pick up a non-static piece in the line element due to the induced by R squared terms. This is something which hasn't actually been very well studied yet, but this is something which may be interesting. So the last ingredient, and this will more or less conclude my review, and I don't know how I'm doing in time, probably not too well, is that one needs a modified version of the entropy. For entropy, the area law for the entropy, which I say that the entropy of a black hole is one quarter of the area in the appropriate units, is not correct for theories where you have higher derivative terms. And for that, you need a somewhat more generalized procedure. And the one we use, the one which was proposed by Wald. And it roughly says the following. You take any diffeomorphism invariant action. You vary this action with respect to the Riemann tensor. You contract suitably with binormals to the horizon, and you integrate over the horizon. That gives you a conserved charge, which is the entropy. So I just sketched the Lagrangian again. This is the Einstein-Hilbert term. Of course, if...
So what do you call the entropy conserved charge?
Excuse me?
What do you call the entropy conserved charge? The entropy
right, so... Okay, I made a... What I wanted to say is that it's based on a Noether charge procedure. Sorry, I somehow... Fortunately, it's written here, otherwise I would... So if you vary the Einstein-Hilbert term, you get the area. So this reproduces the normal result. You get one quarter of the area, actually. And the area is expressed in this complicated combination here. And if you take the explicit R squared terms and vary those with respect to the Riemann tensor and plug it in at the horizon, you get this explicit correction term. So the entropy has the area piece plus this explicit correction term. and everything is to be evaluated on the horizon. That means I have to solve the tractor equations and then plug this into this expression here. This is something which my collaborators already knew when I was starting to learn how to do integrations and stuff like that. So if you do this for this very particular example I showed you before, namely this generic Calabi-O here, you solve the tractor equations, you plug it into the formula I just showed you. Remember, this formula had two different terms and there were no square roots or anything, but if you go through the whole process, you see that without any other approximations, you build up this square root, where this is the leading term, it's the term leading in large charges, and then there's this correction term which goes with the second Chern class. So this comes from here, and this guy comes from the tree-level result. And this is exactly the formula I showed you before for these M5 brains wrapped on a four-cycle times S1. So this is also something which, unfortunately, I was still too young to actually do. So this is a result which is the microscopic part is Maldacena, Stroming, Witten, and this is my collaborators, which I haven't named yet. This is Gabriel Cardoso, Bernard de Witt, and Thomas Mohaupt. So what I'll be doing now is the following. I'll be now looking at a more special case, namely heterotic black holes, because the reason is that one has a direct correspondence with bound states of bound string states, and one can also obtain exact non-perturbative results in that context. And that is actually due to the fact that one just knows what these functions f are to great precision.
So you said that back in 2000, you and your collaborators found solutions with the R-squared corrections.
So
the question is, over the past year, of course, we've heard about these solutions where you actually have a finite-size horizon when you add the R-squared corrections.
Yes, so...
Do your solutions have horizons?
Yes, so the thing is, probably the mistake we did, we never really explicitly started to construct many of the solutions. So what we have is we have the explicit equations which and the explicit solutions in the absence of R squared terms. As soon as you put in switch on R squared terms, this becomes an iterative procedure in determining these solutions. So depending on how hard you want to work, you can it's clear that the procedure is explicit in the sense that you can solve order by order. So without R squared terms, the solutions are explicitly known for single center or multiple center. And if you start in doing R squared terms, you just have to work hard and take many derivatives and add these corrections to solutions and so on. So it's an iterative procedure. What is being done at the moment with these resolving these singularities by including higher R squared corrections still is not quite clear to me, for the following reason, because this is what we're dealing here is an effective action. And that means you should take the tree level, you should solve the tree level, you should take the higher derivative terms and calculate corrections to this tree level results. Now here, in the case that these people have been looking at, the tree level result is just singular. So they take the first higher derivative term and take this into the starting point, solve that big equation, and then they would continue. So this is a bit of something I don't really know yet. Well, it seems to work because they get the correct entropy, but strictly speaking, I don't completely understand the method behind that yet. But that was, of course, that wasn't your question. Your question was if we had explicit solutions for R squared terms.
Right.
And my answer is we have an explicit procedure with which you could construct them if you wish to work hard. There are some examples where first such corrections have been actually, that we actually tested this in a follow-up paper of the one I showed you before. So type 2 on K3 times T2 is much simpler because it stops here. This is F1, this is F0. The only thing that one has to care about now are alpha prime corrections. And this is actually a very interesting thing. You see, Y1 divided by Y0 is something that one usually identifies with the dilaton. It's the Kähler modulus of this T2 factor. This T2 factor, whereas the other ratios are the Kähler moduli of the K3. And this theory is believed to have an exact duality symmetry. And this duality symmetry has a target space duality symmetry and also has an S duality. So these are the modular transformations you're probably familiar with from string theory. Now, the somewhat hairy point here is that these are exact symmetries. These should be exact symmetries of the quantum theory. But these Wilsonian actions, they actually don't necessarily capture all the physical symmetries. The thing that would capture the physical symmetries are the quantum effective actions. But as you also might know, the quantum effective actions in general are not local, and there's no notion of holomorphicity. So what we are doing now is we're doing a type of a hybrid kind of thing. We are taking the Wilsonian actions, we're deriving the entropy, the solutions, and then we somehow close our eyes and we generalize. We include certain terms we need for S-duality, and look what we get. But it's not that we could like write down the whole quantum effective action. You know, we just don't know how to do that in a reasonable context. So our philosophy will be, we do everything without all of these complications, and then we impose S-duality by hand and see what we get. And part of the recent progress is actually that we understand more or less precisely how to do it and also how to test this. So one example, for instance, and this is an example which was worked out in a very nice paper of Harvey and Moore quite some time ago, is the coupling here of the R squared term. Remember, this is the beginning of this R squared term. Perturbatively, I just showed you on the previous slide, there's the dilaton here, which multiplies this. But there are a whole bunch of alpha prime correction, and you can resum them, and what you find is that you actually get here this eta function, the Dedekind eta function. But for this coupling to be S-duality invariant, there's a certain amount of S plus S bar of non-holomorphicity, which has to multiply the eta function such that this is a modular invariant object. So this is the result they find out of string scattering, and string scattering, of course, computes for you a quantum effective action. This is the reason why there's an S bar floating. This is a coupling we could not reproduce. You cannot reproduce this using a Wilsonian action, which is based on holomorphicity, because then this coupling in front of the C square would have to be holomorphic in S. But nevertheless, we can incorporate these non-holomorphic effects into the attractor equations, into the entropy, and so on, by just modifying this function f here and not going actually back to the action, but just taking our equations and generalizing those. And what you find is that, well, you have here the tree-level part, then you have this non-perturbative part here, this w squared eta to the 12th, this is this term here. And then you get these extra non-holomorphic corrections. So you see this here, this function here will now depend on y and y bar, something which is actually forbidden in a Wilsonian action approach. Yes?
So supersymmetry didn't require this to be holomorphic? You're not breaking supersymmetry, but...
Well, you see, supersymmetry is realized at the quantum level in a very complicated way, because the quantum effective action is non-local and so on. But if you want local supersymmetry with the local action, then you need holomorphicity.
Okay, so by adding these non-holomorphic terms, you're somehow explicitly breaking supersymmetry in this.
You see, what we are doing is we're taking the result and we're generalizing the result. The only thing I'm trying to make clear here is it's not that we are rewriting a non-holomorphic action and rederiving all the properties, because we couldn't do this because we relied heavily on the supersymmetry. But we take our results and we just generalize those in order to have the correct symmetries which the physical objects should actually also have. So if you do this, and now it will become more and more technical, I'm afraid. This is the result for k3 times t2. So the first two equations, and I even had to take a small pen to write them, these are the attractor equations, including non-holomorphic terms here. You have s plus s bar. So these are these non-holomorphic additions I put in. And this is an equation for the imaginary and for the real part. And alpha here, this just signals that this comes from the R squared term. So if I just flip off these two lines here, then of course you can see immediately how you could solve them for S and S bar. So these expressions would be just given by these combinations of charges. What I should mention is that these charges are these big vectors here, which take, for experts will probably know this, they take values in this charge lattice, gamma 22.6. So these are the non-holomorphic generalizations. Now you can say, well, who tells you that this is just justified? Because you could add any S-duality invariant quantity to it, you know, and this would still be a good generalization. And part of the progress, I think, is that we can derive this form, which was actually conjectured also quite long ago, but maybe in a bit untransparent way by my collaborators in 98. You can derive this from this microscopic dynamic formula, which I'll be telling you just shortly. The same for the entropy. This looks a bit neater here. So the entropy is expressed. I solved all the attractor equations for the K3 directions, and I'm left only with an entropy which is expressed in terms of the dilaton field, which is subject to these two attractor equations. And so here I find the leading contribution. This will be the area. And this is a sub-leading contribution, which comes with all these etas and has this non-holomorphic piece in it. So the aim will be, and this will be the final part of the talk, I will actually derive this from the microscopical formula which Dijkstra-Verlinde-Verlinde give us for the degeneracy of dions.
So you're basically working with a case where you have four non-zero charges. So these solutions would have an ordinary horizon extremal limit.
Okay, I'm always working in the limit where all these charges here are big and generic. In the limit where certain or almost all the charges, like all the magnetic charges, are zero, these are very pathological situations, and I personally don't really know how to deal with them. I will always be using that these things here are large and generic. In particular, you know, I will be inverting matrices which depend on these larges being big and generic. Another very nice thing, which is something we just realized in retrospect, is that these two equations here are actually equations that come when you extremize this function S, the entropy in terms of the dilaton with respect to S and S bar. Now this is not obvious, and that's why we realized only after we had the microscopic insight. But in retrospect, one might have expected this, and this is part of the speculative part of my talk, because I'll be talking a little bit about variational principles for black hole entropy now. And the aim of this part is now to also make the bridge to what Oguri, Stroming, and Waffa have conjectured with the topological strings. So I gave you this heterotic formula as a reference for something I will show you at the very end. And now this is a type of intermezzo. So it's actually been quite a long time that the black hole area for these particular black holes extremizes something. Now, I forgot actually how they called this object that is extremized, but I thought it was the central charge, but I I didn't look it up this morning. So there's some objects that these people burned and collaborators wrote down, whose extrema is exactly the entropy, and whose extremality conditions are the attractor equations. And something very similar, this was done without R-squared terms. And then Ohuri, Shong, and Wafa came along last year, and they figured out that the black hole entropy, including R-squared terms, is actually the Legendre transform of a free energy, of some function which they identified with the free energy. Now, you might know that the Legendre transform, you can also view this as a variational principle. You write down a function and you vary with respect to the variable you want to eliminate, and this then imposes, at the saddle point, this imposes the Legendre transformation. So I'd like to summarize these two discussions in the following, and this, although I'll be only working with R-squared terms, you could actually also include all non-holomorphic corrections, but I'm leaving them aside just for simplicity. So what I claim is the following. The object that you're actually varying is the Hesse potential. So this is the Hesse potential which corresponds to the Kähler geometry of the moduli space of complex structures, say, or of Kähler moduli. So this is the moduli spaces of compactification. So this is the Hesse potential. I'll say in a moment what this is written like. So this doesn't depend on the charges, and then there's a piece which does depend on the charges, and this is something which Ohuri, Verlinde, and Wafa called the superpotential, but is in the older literature is called the holomorphic BPS mass. So I'll first tell you what those are. The holomorphic BPS mass is something which is linear in the charges. So this, the electric charge here, the magnetic charge there, and it gets multiplied with the real parts of the periods. So real part of yi and real part of fi. And the Hesse potential has two parts. It has an explicit R squared term, and it contains a part which is something which is called the exponentiated Kähler potential. Now, it's not obvious, but if you work this out, you can see that this Hesse potential only depends on the real parts of the period. So it depends only on the real part of y and the real part of fi. The nice thing is that these R squared terms fit naturally into a geometric object, which is this Hesse potential. So this has a geometric meaning. Now, if you vary this function sigma with respect to the real parts of the periods, you get back exactly the attractor equations. And hidden in this fi here are, of course, the R squared corrections again, because fi, you know, depends on w squared. And on the extremum, so if I impose these two in conditions of extremality, then you can see that you get out the black hole entropy formula I showed you before a few transparencies ago. So this is nice, but what's the connection with OSV? Now remember that this function fi, you can also regard this not as an independent coordinate, but actually as a derivative of a function f which depends on y. Now, so you can swap the real part of fi with the imaginary part of yi as an independent variable. And so this is what I'll be doing now. And so if I extremize this function sigma with respect to the imaginary part of yi, then I get exactly, funny enough, I get exactly the magnetic attractor equation again. So if I solve this, I express yi in terms of the magnetic charge plus a yet unknown real part. Plugging this back into sigma, I find that sigma in terms of the real part phi and the magnetic charge is given by 4 pi times the imaginary part of f minus qi phi I. Now, people who follow the discussion a little bit see that this is exactly the object which Ohuri, Strong, and Wafa suggested to be the free energy. So this is when extremized the entropy. This is the free energy, and you see this. You know, this has this typical structure of a Legendre transform. So what I'm claiming here is that this variational principle that Auguste Strong and Waffa suggested in the presence of R squared terms is like the halfway extremization of another underlying functional. Of course, classically, you know, you can transform back and forth. You don't lose information, so this is a bit of a political statement, I guess, I just made. Well, not political, I mean a biased statement, sorry. Now the exciting part is that if you take this curly F, this free energy, and you express it in terms of what is actually computed by the topological string, namely F top, then you have an extra factor of 1 over 2 pi I and so forth, and you work out the factors, and then you find that it's exactly the real part, 2 times the real part, of the topological partition sum. So if you, for some reason, exponentiate e to the curly F, writing down something like the black hole partition sum, then you see that it's given by the absolute squared of the topological partition sum. Now this is a level, this is a statement only on the level of, you know, the semi-classical, this is a semi-classical statement as so far. But these three gentlemen, of course, wouldn't be at the place they are if they wouldn't come up with a nice conjecture in this context. And you know, this conjecture is really marvelous because it sparked a whole new view on this problem. So this was very very nice. So they said, well, look, this is actually, although this is only like we derived this semi-classically, we did Legendre transforms. There's actually an underlying, more fundamental type of relationship, namely. The square of the topological string is related to the black hole partition sum by an inverse Laplace transform. In the semi-classical limit, when you do a saddle point approximation, the inverse Laplace transform just becomes a Legendre transform, and you get your semi-classical result back. But what they're saying to you is that you should take this here as something which also tells you something about your microstates. Now, there are many issues here. And although it was very inspiring, I think it's fair to say that this proposal also has certain problems. For one, it's a bit unclear. You know, you just have d phi here. It's not quite clear how symplectic invariance should work out. It's not very clear how all the symmetries like S-duality or T-duality should work out. Then there's a question here about the contours. Do you integrate this from minus infinity to plus infinity, or from 0 to 1, or what do you do? And there's also a problem which I think is still not completely understood. This is that of the holomorphic anomaly, and I think Hiroshi probably told you a possibility on how to resolve this problem. So this would be going back to work of Erik Verlinde on the holomorphic anomaly. And actually, in a paper by de Bolcker, N.F. Moore, and Piolin, they actually found that their measure here that needs a certain type of modification in order to get the correct symmetries, and the modification they proposed was proportional to the charges, which is of course a bit of a fake thing, because something which depends on the charges, and you shouldn't normalize it with you shouldn't multiply with something which depends on the charges in order to get the correct result. So I think they also state in their paper, that this proposal needs a certain sort of modification. It's not that it's completely wrong, it just needs to be made more precise. So I'm coming to the conjectural part of my talk, because I will propose very boldly somewhat an alternative proposal. And it's still boldly because, it'll only come out soon, so I don't really know if everything will really work out the way I want to. Remember that this sigma, this thing I extremized, depended only on the real parts of the periods, yi and fi. And it's actually very simple to write. So I'm looking for something which in the semi-classical limit is just this double extremization. So I could write down an integral like this here. If I do a semi-classical approximation to this integral, I will just get the double Legendre transform. But the nice thing is that this combination here, this is automatically symplectically invariant. It has to do with the fact that this real part and that the real part of the periods are parts of a vector, and you know, like any, and this, you know, so this thing gets transformed with the determinant of the symplectic transformation, which is 1. So that's why this is manifestly symplectic invariant. The nice thing is you can now use the fact that f can also be written as a derivative of a function, and you can so write this in complex coordinates, and then you get an extra measure factor here, which is just a determinant of the period matrix. And if you write e to the sigma in terms of complex variables, you find an e to the k, and then you find something which looks like a wave function squared. Now this is a intriguing thing, and I don't really know quite what it means, but it's anyway, I recognize this often in people who did Kähler quantization or geometric quantization, often come up with this type of integrals. Now, this is like this proposal is also not quite definite yet, because you see, this is a detail, but I think, you know, there's still an issue with the background independence of this proposal, but I cannot say anything about this now. So, although this looks more promising, there are still some serious problems. So, the reason why this only hasn't appeared yet is because, for instance, if you try to use this formula for one half BPS case, you run into problems again. What you find, for instance, that there's this measure factor here, that this becomes 0. And at the same time, the integrand here starts to explode and stuff like that. So there are all kind of divergences we don't quite understand yet.
Question: this thing being called S sub BH, which is a number of states, right?
Yes.
Is that really an index? I mean, is it literally an index? So it should be writable in many different forms by the usual sort of.
People assume that this should actually be that this is actually an index and. In any case, when we'll be looking at the dions, I think it is an index, yes. So it could be negative, say. Right? Now, nevertheless, although this proposal still has a bit of some problems, you know, maybe we'll be able to resolve them, maybe not. It does have some nice properties. For instance, if you do the saddle point approximation, and I'll be only very sketchy on this because I want to finish my talk at some point, then you find that if you do this whole thing, saddle point approximation, what you find is that the fluctuation determinants you get from doing this in a saddle point approximation, so this is the determinant of the second derivative of sigma, that this always cancels precisely one factor of this measure. So this is something which didn't have to happen, but it did happen. And of course, if you would have forgotten this measure factor as some people have, then of course these would pop up as extra terms in your entropy. These would be subleading terms. So this is, I think this is a nice, this is already a nice indication that it goes into the correct direction. So in saddle point approximation, one gets exactly that e to the black hole entropy is given by the Legendre transform, and there are no other subleading corrections which would come out from doing the saddle point approximation in leading order. So what I'd like to talk about now, and I'm probably seriously over time already.
Three. Everyone will leave for cooking soon.
Okay, I'll try to be, I don't have so much, so I'll be very, I have like 15 more minutes now.
Well, that's what people need for cooking. That's kind of your cutoff.
Oh, okay, I'm managing 15. So now I'd like to, you see, now I have all kind of ideas. I have a review, I have some, haywire proposal about, so can we somehow test this? Is there something, you know, we know that we could say, well, this is wrong, this is right. And I think the only place that, you know, this OSV conjecture can actually be tested in a non-trivial way, meaning comparing sub-leading terms, is actually in this n equals to 4 case, where there's an exact formula for the degeneracy of dyons. And this is what I'll be talking about. So in these n equals to 4 compactification, you can have two type of BPS states. You can have 1/2 BPS states. These are purely electric or purely magnetic, magnetically charged. And there's an exact degeneracy formula known for such purely electric states, say. So this is just given by, again, this Dedekind function to the 24. And the way this formula works is here, you're advised to take a contour integration somewhere in the upper half plane from 0 to 1. And while doing this integration, you will pick, so eta, you know, has a certain expansion in terms of e to the 2i pi sigma. And so you will pick up the pole, while doing this integration, you will pick up the pole, you will pick up the coefficient of the pole, which is determined by the value of q squared. So if you start expanding eta, you know, the lowest level will be, the coefficient will be 1, that's the ground state, and then you'll have 24, which I think are the 24 oscillators, and so on. So now for large values of Q, you can derive an asymptotic formula, and probably I guess many people have maybe done it already. If not, you can read this in Green Schwartz Witten, for instance, and you find that the log of the degeneracy is given by the square root of Q squared, basically. And then there's a correction term, which is minus 27 divided by 4 times log of the same q squared. So q again is this, q is this vector in the charge lattice gamma 22,6. Now, to leading order, this can be is successfully, so the leading order here is successfully compared to the R squared corrected black holes, or previously it was successfully compared to the black holes with stretched horizons. And this is basically work of the Bolkar Sen and recently also of the Stanford group. But there remain certain discrepancies at the subleading order. And I think these have not been resolved yet. These may have to do with the fact that, you know, these electric states from a point of view of supergravity are somehow not really generic enough. So one idea is to take a generic, more generic situation, which is the one called a BPS. And here there's a very nice formula of Dijkstra, Verlinde, and Verlinde, which is the following. They say, okay, look, the degeneracy of states determined by P and Q, electric and magnetic charges, is given again by such a contour integral here. This was a contour integral in one variable. Here it's a contour integration again. But it's in terms of the omega. Omega is a period matrix of a genus 2 surface, so it has three components, rho, sigma, and v, I call them. So this is a three-dimensional contour integration here. Then you can have such a charge factor, e to the q omega q. This is the analogon of e to the ip sigma q squared, except that it's sandwiched in a more complicated way with this period matrix. And then you have this beast here, phi 10 of omega, which is this mysterious automorphic form of degree 10. Well, at least I probably still don't really know 100%, you know, everything about automorphic forms. This is a whole literature, and the only things are, you know, I don't really know too much. So if you want to grill me, you can ask me questions on technical details here. But I knew enough, at least, to calculate, I mean, with my collaborators, to calculate the asymptotic degeneracy. Actually, don't need to know too much. So this omega here is this period matrix. And I think the principal idea, and here again, you might, you know, you probably would need someone like Robert Dijkgraaf to explain how they came up with this result. There's a way to understand it from symmetric orbifolds, but this is like my pharma type of approach here. So I'm drawing not world sheets, but target space pictures here. So here I have like a 1/2 BPS string, and here I have a 1/2 BPS string. And the idea is probably, with emphasis on probably, if you want to calculate an index or a trace, you somehow have to, you know, you have to calculate something periodic. You have to make time periodic and then calculate it. And if you know, so you would just close, you know, this loop, and this would give you the one loop amplitude, which is this eta to the 24, if you just would have the blue side. But now you want to look at the bound state of a magnetic and an electric, such electric and a magnetic state, so they're somehow attached to each other. I don't really know why there's only one attachment here, but you know, for the picture it's nice. So now you somehow fold these two tubes together, and you get a genus 2 surface parameterized by these three moduli I showed you before, and there's momentum running along these loops. So this is a, you know, maybe this is the idea, I don't know. It's a bit shaky because, you know, this shouldn't be world. Okay, I'm not quite sure if this is correct, but this picture here is correct in any case. In any case, what you should get is if you take these two bound constituents very far apart and you count their degeneracy, you know, this should just factorize. If you you should see, well, if they're very far apart, you should have the, you know, the degeneracy of the electric times the degeneracy of the magnetic. And in fact, this phi 10 here has a degeneracy limit. If you take this genus 2 surface and you pull it all apart, then this phi 10 factors, and it factors, so the leading contribution in this factorization goes like 1 over eta to the 24, which is the degeneracy of a 1/2 BPS, times eta to the 24 again, the green one, depending on rho, the other modular parameter. And then there's something like the lowest order particle running in between, which is somehow, this people call this a tachyon pole sometimes. And so this phi 10, this has this remarkable property that in this degeneracy limit, it actually does factorize in this form. In fact, this is more or less the only thing one actually has to know about phi 10. Still, I'll have to give you, on my second to the last slide, I'll give you some technicalities here. So phi 10, just to make this a bit more precise, phi 10 is an automorphic form. That means under an sp2 transformation, it will, phi 10 transforms with a determinant of this matrix here to the 10th power. And the interesting thing is that it is related to the elliptic genus of K3. And you can see this from this product representation here. This is something you can also find in a nice paper of Krisenko-Kulin and also in a paper of Kawai. And this elliptic genus is the factor here, C, KL, K times L, comma M. Another thing you need to know to do the calculation is that all the zeros of phi 10, so everywhere where this phi 10 becomes zero, is at the point v squared, or sp2 transforms of this. So I showed you this before. If I take the inverse of this, then I see that, you know, this here has a zero at v squared equals to zero. And all the zeros of these functions are in the orbit of the sp2 z of this zero. So every time you have a zero, that means you have a pole. If you take the inverse of this, and such a pole will potentially contribute when picking up such a when picking up the Fourier coefficient, because what you're picking up is the coefficient in front of these poles. Now, but this is a very subtle thing, and I just wanted to point out that for these, this function here has poles also in the Siegel upper half plane and not just on the boundary, and that makes explicit calculation for low-lying states very difficult, and was actually one of the reasons why in the beginning people thought this formula might not be correct, but it's a very subtle thing to to actually do this correctly. And I definitely don't know how to do it correctly for low-lying states. So my second to the last transparency is this here. There's also an S-duality. The S-duality is realized as a subgroup of the symplectic group on this genus 2 symplectic group. And the asymptotic degeneracy is related to not V squared, but this derisor here, which is a transform of V squared. This is also part of the input that DVV gave us. And DVV already realized that with this divisor, they reproduce something which goes proportional to the area of these black holes. So what we've done here is probe this also to all orders in alpha prime. So how do you go about? What we did is we performed a contour integration around the zero of this divisor here. I could explain this in more detail, but it's a bit of a technical thing. And then did a saddle point approximation for in terms of rho and sigma. Remember that my integral was integral over rho, sigma, and v. So one I did exactly in terms of I picked up a residue, and here I do them approximately in the saddle point approximation. And what you find is that the degeneracy is given, so this is after step one, after picking up the residue. It contains the remaining two integrations, then there's a measure factor here, and then there's an e to the I pi x. And this x now, you see, if I would be, now I of course should have this other slide with this supergravity result here. This x here is of rho and sigma is nothing else than the thing I showed you before from the supergravity, if I make a suitable identification of variables. So the integrands would match under a suitable identification of variables. And can I actually prove that, you know, this identification is true? Well, in any case, if I look at the saddle point equation, so the point where this integrand here is extremized, then this coincides again precisely with these non-holomorphic attractor equations. And at least to leading order, I could show that the attractor equations are actually equivalent to these saddle point equations of in the DVV formula. Another very nice thing that happens is that if you then do the saddle point approximation and you calculate the fluctuation determinant, this is always something you have to take along, then at leading order it partially cancels certain non-covariant terms in this measure factor and leaves out only covariant pieces. So this type of cancellation of certain parts of the fluctuation terms against the measure is something we find in this formulation as well, something we also saw, you know, in this other variational principle I gave you. So now I guess the punchline, which isn't a punchline, is the last slide here. This is what the punchline should be. Can we compare DVV with the proposal I gave you before? So the proposal I gave you before was this integral with this non-trivial measure factor and this e to the sigma. It has it looks similar, but it is unfortunately not quite. What I can do is I can massage this expression and integrate out all the K3 directions. And what I wind up is a complex integral, you know, with an invariant measure. This is probably to be taken over a fundamental domain, but this is some part of the prescription we don't know. Then there's a non-trivial measure factor I just denote by z squared. And there's this integrand, which is the very same integrand I showed you before, that I've, you know, found in the supergravity and also in the DVV formula. However, if I just compare this straightforwardly with the DVV formula, there are certain subtleties. So I can also massage that, the rho and sigma integration, into something which looks similar like here, except that S bar is actually not necessarily the complex conjugate as this this an S twiddle here, and this S twiddle is not necessarily the complex conjugate of S as it was in this proposal here. And also these measure factors, they agree at the leading order, but they don't at the non-leading order. So this would coincide if I, for some reason, would know why this identification is correct. And this here, you know, you could argue that these are just different microscopic. These would differ by, you know, these are microscopic effects, and one is correct and one is wrong. I think this is not such a big. This is the bigger problem. Remember also that the DVV formula made use of contour integrations, and here this really looks like a complex integration. And it's not necessarily the case that two contours, you know, fill up a whole fundamental domain or anything like this. So the conclusion is that the proposal I gave you is probably a first step in the right direction, but I don't think it's the last word. And I'm not so optimistic anymore as I used to be that actually one can match up an OSV-related conjecture precisely with the DVV type of formula. And another headache, but this is something I didn't talk about, is that the electric case, the 1/2 BPS case, is still rather a headache and still poses problems. So this was this everything. Thank you.
Are there no questions? Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.